This is WABF, and it's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Capominosi of the Common Sense Campaign, an adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash, as well as an anonymous donor. And good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, good morning.
It's
right back to you.
Monday again.
Here we are. I see you're trying to get me to get the microphone
there
up
go.
There. All right. Now we're set.
We can get going. We are ready.
All right, folks. So here we are coming up on Christmas. And, of course, everyone's focus is on getting ready for Christmas. And I'm certainly part of that. But as we focus on that, there are some important things that we really should take a look at. And so this morning, I want to try to do that, okay? And I think I want to start with Pearl Harbor. And you say, well, gee, Lou, it's kind of over. That's true, but this, I can't help the fact that we do a Monday show.
Right.
And so here we are. So I want to talk about Pearl Harbor from the perspective of here you have a situation 81 years ago, Pearl Harbor happens, and why did it happen, okay? And what was the context of the interplay between the United States and Japan that led to war, okay? And now I want you to think about it from this perspective. Here's the rising Asian power, Japan, and we're going to talk about how that works itself out. And guess what? 81 years later, we're still dealing with a rising Asian power. Duh. Don't you think there might be some, you know, lessons learned? And I want to try to tease some of those things out, okay? And again, I know I've talked about this with China and all like that before, but when you start looking at things from a historical perspective, it's interesting how history does repeat itself. And I know a lot of people poo-poo that, but it's kind of interesting, once again, to see where we are with another rising Asian power that could very well lead to, you know, very difficult situations in the future. So I do want to talk about that. I also want to talk about this business with Twitter, okay? I mean, it's absolutely incredible, and I'm not going to editorialize on it right now. I'll get into it. But we need to kind of dig into that a little bit and see what's going on with it. I also want to talk about the Georgia elections. Obviously, we're all hoping Herschel Walker would win. He didn't. So now you've got, you know, the Democrats with a 51-49 split in the Senate. But then Sinema just departs from the Democratic Party. Thank goodness she did. But we'll see where the Sinema Manchin axis of opposition to hardcore left-wing Democrats really goes this time around. You know, we'll see. After that, I do want to talk about this incredible prisoner swap, which I'm sure you've probably heard about. But we need to kind of think carefully about this and why it happened and the political dynamics that I think are driving the Biden administration, not only on the prisoner swap, but on so many other issues that are just so apparent that are not in the national interest, okay? Lots of competing arguments about that, competing interpretations, theories, whatever you want to say. But let's kind of take a look at it from the conservative watchdog perspective, okay? I do want to try to get into a couple of local issues, all right? And one of them has to do with the I-10 bridge. I had a meeting last week with Senator Greg Allbritton, who is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and he obviously has an interest in this. So I want to share a few things with you all about what was discussed and perhaps where we're going with that. And then lastly, time permitting, I want to spend a little bit of time on Baldwin County Schools report card, what's happened with their latest results on the ACAP scores. Again, I've spoken about this at their board meetings, and I've spoken about it here. And, you know, we're still fighting this. And I think that we're fighting Common Core. And again, our argument has been it's Common Core that is the only variable that explains why we're having so many problems with math and everything else. So I want to get into that a little bit. Okay. So having laid the groundwork for this nice hour show. Laurie, I have to say, I really enjoy having an extra half hour. It
feels
really
like
makes it better for everybody. Okay,
relax and get everything in usually.
Well,
that
I don't
you
know if
talk
I can
about.
Relax, but there's no relaxation in getting ready for it because it, you know, you have to take a little bit more time. But let's begin with this whole question about where and why Pearl Harbor continues to make why we should look at Pearl Harbor as we deal with the rising power of China. Okay, so there's a school of thought, the revisionist school of thought, that of course there's revisionists everywhere. I mean, 1619 is the ultimate revision of American history. But there are some historians who want to blame America for Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. So you're saying to yourself, why is he going straight here? I thought we were going to have some context about a rising power. You'll get the context. Just give me a chance, okay? I want to just get this out because it is just incredibly aggravating to see where some of these historians want to go with the blame America crowd, just like Obama did in his Cairo speech in 2009, okay? This is where they think, okay? This is what they think. Okay, so you have the revisionist school that basically says, well, you know, when Roosevelt cut off the Japanese oil, that was it. That meant that the Japanese had to go to war. I said, okay, well, let's take a look at that theory for a second, okay? Let's run the reel back to 1940, okay? And this is after the fall of France. And the fact of the matter was, during that particular period of time, the Japanese had pushed hard on the French to occupy French Indochina, right? This created yet another issue for Roosevelt, who was already dealing with the fact that the Japanese had launched an attack on China in 1937. And again, you go back and look at some of the Life magazine pictures that were coming out of that war, particularly the rape of Nanking. American public opinion was absolutely appalled at the pictures of Chinese children, you know, sitting near railroad tracks that have, and just, you know, crying because this devastation was so great. The whole question of the rape of Nanking is well documented, okay? And what I'm suggesting to you is that the question of Japanese-American relations just deteriorated as Japan committed atrocity after atrocity, such as the rape of Nanking, that led to a very real problem in Japanese-American relations, okay? Now, as I mentioned a minute ago, the revisionists want you to believe that it's American foreign policy that pushed the Japanese down the road to war, okay? Let's kind of think about this from the standpoint of Admiral Yamamoto, who was the chief of all of the Japanese Navy, and what was he thinking, okay? Now, understand that Yamamoto had been to America. He had a degree from Harvard. He had been in the 1920s. He had been as part of the naval attaché in Washington, D.C. He knew the United States. And he was concerned that his own politicians, and especially the Japanese army that had a lot of influence, were pushing for an expansion of war. And if it meant the Americans getting into it, too bad. Basically, what the argument was, Japan needed to go into the British and Dutch East Indies and get the oil and other resources that they need. So yes, oil was a critical thing. 90% of the oil was being brought in from outside sources, and it still is today. But the point is, understand what Yamamoto was thinking about, okay? He understood that any kind of a war with the United States may have given Japan a short amount of success, if it was done correctly, which I'll get to in a minute, but it also, in his view, it laid bare the absolute absurdity of trying to go to war with the United States. We had more resources. We had a better industrial base. We were not going to lose that war. And Yamamoto understood that. But despite his reservations, he also understood the direction that his leaders were going in. So whether it was the war on China or whether it was the planned movement into the East Indies to take the Dutch colonies, and they've already taken the French colony of Indochina, but that wasn't a resource for them, except for rice. But the British colonies of Singapore, all of those places had strategic value, not just resource value. So for Yamamoto, the issue of dealing with the resource, the lack of resources that Japan had, led him to believe, and this is the point that I find most interesting in refuting these revisionist historians. It led him to believe that the only way that the Japanese could actually, you know, make progress in terms of trying to move into the southern areas to get the resources was to destroy the American fleet that was now based in Hawaii. Previously, it was in San Diego, California. But in, I think it was 1940, Roosevelt shifted the fleet to Hawaii. Now, some people see this as a major mistake. We can argue about that, and there are other issues that are entailed with Roosevelt's whole approach to the Japanese. But for right now, what I'm trying to paint to you is a picture that Yamamoto understood that Japan's situation vis-a-vis the United States and its dependence upon resources such as oil was a severe vulnerability, and that if Japan was going to be able to seize the necessary resources in the southern area, then it meant that the American fleet had to be taken care of. Okay? Now, run the reel back just a little bit further, okay? You've got the fall of France in June of 1940. You've got the Japanese putting pressure on the French to be able to occupy Indochina. They occupy Indochina. And what Roosevelt does, again, this is part of the idea of sanctions, which we are involved with sanctions today. Sanctions were imposed on the Japanese. Roosevelt abrogated the 1911 trade treaty. So right there is a marker, okay, that Roosevelt was concerned about the course of Japan's foreign policy, expanding further into the rest of Southeast Asia. Now, one can argue that for the last 3 years, we had watched what was going on with the Japanese attack on China. And yes, it did cause a lot of consternation. And yes, there were issues with American citizens. There was the issue of the Panay gunboat that was, you know, shot up by the Japanese, mistakenly, supposedly. So Japanese-American relations were fraught with problems right after Japan started to attack China. Okay? And understand that Roosevelt had a lot of sympathy for China, in part because of what I just said a little while ago about the rape of Nanking and all those kinds of things happening. But he had family relationships because they had Roosevelt missionaries that had been in China for a long time. Now, the point here is, it's now the summer of 1940. America has abrogated the 1911 trade treaty. Okay? Does it cut off the oil? Ooh, well, that's a good question there, Dr. Liu. Did they? No, they didn't cut off the oil, which they probably should have, but they didn't. Okay? Roosevelt did not want to create a crisis in Japanese-American relations, although the abrogation of the 1911 trade treaty certainly was a step towards making it much more difficult for the Japanese to do what they were doing and expanding their control over, you know, other parts of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, and particularly trying to incorporate what they had called the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, okay, which is nothing more than a colonization of Asia. Okay, that's all this was. And to tell you the truth, it sort of sounds to me like the Belt and Road, which is nothing more than a neo-colonization, you know, with the Chinese now in charge. But be that as it may, here we are frozen in 1940, okay? The revisionist historians are going to tell us that once Roosevelt cut off the oil, that was the key thing that drove Japan to war. And here is the tell, though. What did Yamamoto do between the summer of 40 and December of 40? He looked, he observed, he started planning. And what he started to plan came to his mind in December of 1940, which he briefed one of his trusted admirals about a plan to attack Pearl Harbor, to knock out the American fleet, which would give Japan the opportunity to consolidate its planned foray into Southeast Asia, further than Indochina, down into Singapore and the Netherlands, East Indies. Now think about this. He's got a plan to attack Pearl Harbor in December of 1940. By January of 41, he has brought his staffs together, and they are now doing detailed operational planning. Now you're thinking to yourself, okay, that's pretty good. So where are you going with this? Here's where I'm going with it. It's not until the summer of 1941 do we cut off the oil. And yet, lo and behold, the reality is Yamamoto has already started planning the Pearl Harbor attack. Not over the oil, not over the trade embargo from 1911. No. He understands that what Tojo and the rest of the Japanese political establishment are doing is inevitably going to lead to war, because the Americans are not going to just sit idly by while Japan continues to move in the direction it's going. He basically saw the inevitability of war between the United States and Japan. 6 months before we cut off the oil. So let's just be clear about this. The issue about who started this clearly takes us right down the road of, you know, what totally opposed to this revisionist theory that the United States really instigated World War II because we cut the oil off from Japan. Yamamoto understood exactly what was going on, planned the operation, and began the operational training necessary to make it happen. Okay? So, where does this lead us then in terms of where we are today with Xi and China? I've suggested to you that one of the key things for us to be able to do is to demonstrate to Xi and the Chinese that Taiwan is not going to just be given over to them, okay? And this business of strategic ambiguity, which Biden has inherited, okay, is a prescription for a disaster. Because guess what? As Z looks at this situation, what does he see? He sees weakness. He sees a lack of seriousness in terms of coming to grips with the threat that China, you know, poses. If you look at the latest NDEA, the fact of the matter is that Biden's budget was just a no-growth budget. The Senate and them are talking about putting an extra $45 billion in there, which is fine. But that doesn't even begin to cover the inflation that's already set in. So really, in order to cover the inflation, they would have to put another $45 billion in to make it a $90 billion budget increase. So my point here is that what is Z seeing? Does he see any defense efforts being made on the part of us to protect the Taiwanese from the kinds of things that we're seeing going on with the Ukrainians? No. You know, I've suggested to you before that what we need to do is to deploy some Marines out there. You know, we've got Marine units that are certainly capable of putting up resistance if the Chinese decide that they want to try to land on some sort of an amphibious operation, or if they want to just do parachute drops onto key places in Taiwan to take over airports and things like that. But the point is that without some sort of a deterrent capability right there, it seems to me that we are sending the wrong signal, okay? And that wrong signal is a temptation for Z to deal with it. Now, just a few months ago, Z was in a very strong position. Think about this. He was, you know, essentially coronated to be emperor for life. Unbelievable that Chinese Communist Party went ahead and gave him essentially an unlimited term, a third term. Okay? Things were looking fine for him. They had shown an incredible amount of force when Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan. We remember talking about all that. Very capable, you know, naval forces, air forces. They have a lot more planes and ships out there than we do, and missiles. Again, the equation in terms of any kind of a calculation on the part of the Americans to be able to support Taiwan, you know, is fraught with danger. And so, just a few months ago, as I said, Xi was sitting in a very strong position. Now, run the reel forward to just the last month, and what has happened in China? Massive protests throughout the whole country that have created problems for Xi that one could argue had not been foreseen. Many people thought that Xi and the Chinese no COVID policy was exactly what most countries should be doing. Lock them down. No COVID. Well, I mean, we've had our own problems with the COVID issue. Lockdowns don't work. Masks don't work. The vaccines are not a vaccine. They don't prevent you from getting the disease they're supposed to. So how can you call it a vaccine? Be that as it may, China believed that they could deal with COVID by locking down. It has had economic consequences, there's no question about that. But the more important consequence is that the people suddenly rose up and said, hell no, we're not taking it anymore. Since then, you've seen Xi backing off, becoming a little bit more liberal about the no COVID policy. And for him to have to deal with the revolt of the people creates a problem for him. And so, in my view, it's going to be quite natural for him to deflect and misdirect people's attention to an outside boogeyman. And here we are. You know, with our relationship with Taiwan, it's sitting out there unguarded to a certain degree, which would, in my view, create exactly the kind of situation that he can exploit. Because if he does a very quick, forceful attack and takes Taiwan, what's Biden going to do? Okay? For Roosevelt, the Japanese moving into Indochina was the straw that broke the camel's back. The abrogation of the 1911 treaty started us down the road to war. I believe that. But I also believe that it was the final straw came in the summer of 1941 when we embargoed the oil, and the argument here is that what Xi is facing in terms of an America that's really flabby in the Western Pacific, Xi is facing something completely different than what the Japanese did. Although he has his economic problems, although they have oil dependency issues, which they're trying to get from Saudi Arabia. I get that. But what he doesn't face is an America that's ready to draw the line in the sand over Taiwan. And as such, I would argue that is a shiny object just sitting there waiting for him to do what he wants to do to end the whole Taiwan question, number one, and number two, to distract the Chinese people who just rose up in protest against the no COVID policy. So we'll see where this goes. But it seems to me that looking at the Japanese-American relations in the late 40s, I mean in the late 30s to 1941, gives you a sense that if a country is determined to do something, and this is the argument that has been used since Munich and the beginning of World War II in Europe, that weakness begets aggression. And if we're not weak over the Taiwan issue, I don't know how to define weak. Because we certainly are sending mixed signals, and I would argue that these mixed signals at this point have become much more dangerous because Xi's political problem over the protests over his COVID policies has created a situation that he didn't have to deal with just 2 months ago. So what's his solution going to be? What was Japan's solution? Become more aggressive, take more territory, become less dependent upon outside sources for oil. So why is it not a natural place to go in terms of looking at Xi's problems, similar to what the Japanese had to deal with? Xi's problems are not necessarily going to just evaporate. And as such, it seems to me that the temptation for him will be exactly what the Japanese did, was to solve the problem using force. And if his problem is Taiwan, and Hong Kong to a lesser degree, but they've already solved the Hong Kong issue. Taiwan is a beacon of freedom. It is a problem that is only exacerbated by the facts of what just happened in China. So think carefully about this and put Pearl Harbor into the context of, you know, why would Japan do what they did? And if the explanation is along the lines that I've offered to you, then think carefully about why Z may be similarly, you know, motivated to do something just like Japan did, only this time it will be on Taiwan. All right, well, that took a long time. But you know what? I'm sorry. It takes time to go through some of these things. So there you have it. Pearl Harbor, not to be forgotten.
You explain it in a way that we can understand, as if us may have forgotten or never known the history and the implications behind it.
Well, thank you, Laurie.
Thank you.
Well, you can give me a bonus for that then, I guess. I mean, you know, how about an extra 20 minutes? There you go. All right. She's saying, she's laughing, but she ain't giving any 20 minutes.
Well, the attention spans
Yes. Oh, the old attention span argument. Okay. All right. So let's now shift to Twitter. I mean, if there is a WTF moment in the world, we just had it. Okay. Now here's Twitter. You know, the public square, guru of public square, millions of people on Twitter, okay? So what does the public square really mean to Twitter? Well, based on their actions, and again, conservatives were saying this for a long, long time, the public square for Twitter was a public square controlled by the progressive radical left's agenda, okay? Whoa, Dr. Liu, that's pretty strong. No, it's not strong, okay? It's not strong anymore because Elon Musk has just revealed the inner secrets. Now, we've had four dumps of emails from Elon Musk, okay? All of them confirming what the conservatives had been alleging for a long, long time, okay? Now, put this into the context of the former CEO, Jack Dorsey, who, you know, started Twitter. Brilliant move, okay? But here he is in congressional testimony where he's asked, do you shadow ban people? No, that's a lie. We don't do that. I mean, it's pretty clear he was lying based on the emails that we're seeing now, okay? All right, so that in and of itself is bad news. I get that, okay? But the WTF moment that I spoke about wasn't just that. It's where the FBI, because, again, we get back to the collusion over the Russian business with Trump. You can't get away from what the FBI people, the Strucks, the McCabes, and now this guy Baker, who was their chief legal counsel, who left the FBI to go to Twitter. Now, just kind of think with me on this. Here we have this band of brothers in the FBI who hate Trump and are doing everything they can to push the Steele dossier. How many times do we have to say the Steele dossier was a lie to begin with? Okay? And yet, what did the FBI leadership, Strzok, Page, McCabe, all of these guys, what did they do with that? Do you think that they just dropped it and said, oh, well, it turns out not to be true. We got to go on to move on to something else. We'll find something else. No, no, no. They stuck with it. They kept using it. They used it to get FISA applications. And here again, this guy, Baker, okay? He's got a laundry list of things. Excuse me. Okay? I mean, he is part and parcel of dealing with exonerating Hillary Clinton in when they found out all of the files that she had at home that weren't supposed to be there. Okay? He pushed getting a FISA warrant against Trump, knowing full well that the information given to the judge was wrong. There was no basis for it. Okay? So, I mean, we've been through this forever. Okay? I'm not going to repeat all this stuff. All I'm going to say to you is, how is it possible that the emails reveal that the FBI leadership, people are working with Twitter right before the election of 2020. Okay? They're meeting. They're talking about things. They're offering, you know, things that Twitter should, you know, lowball, drop, people that they should, you know, keep off, so that information, particularly about the Hunter Biden laptop. This is what really kind of created that with the FBI. They sat on the Hunter Biden laptop for 19 months, okay? No, not 19 months. It was, yeah, well, they got it in December of 2019, so they had it for 9 months when all this blew up and Miranda Devine, you know, found out about it, and they posted it in the New York Post, which, again, look at the FBI's responsibility with Twitter to shut down the Post story. Okay, now you're saying, okay, that's bad news. You're right, it's bad news. I mean, this is the problem where you have a secret police, essentially, a group within the FBI that's moving in the direction to suppress political opposition, particularly from the fact that they don't want Trump to come back as the president again. Now, I mean, look, I suppose we can go back to J. Edgar Hoover, former director of the FBI, okay? I mean, there are abuses there. There's no question about that. But I would argue that whatever Hoover was doing with the FBI doesn't even come close. I want to say pales in comparison, but that's not even apt. It doesn't even come close to pales in comparison. What these people were doing was nothing more than using the police powers of the state to take care of their political enemies. Okay? So, now, here again, another aspect of this is that Musk's revelations have also shown that at the same time that the Twitter people were meeting with the FBI folks and others, they were also meeting with the Biden campaign. Oh, oops here. Real oops. Now, what happens if future revelations take us down the road where the Biden administration is continuing to work with Twitter? Now you have a constitutional crisis of the first order. Think about this. Now, fortunately, the Republicans have taken the House. So, for all of you out there who are saying, oh, all they're going to do is investigate, we can't have any of that. Guess what? I want them to investigate this crap. You've got to be kidding me. Investigate. They should subpoena, investigate, and force the Democrats to deal with the obvious, okay? Force them to deal with the obvious. And if the Democrats don't, well, maybe they'll pay a political price. But I guess what? I mean, this idea of the political price being paid, I guess I'm just old school. I mean, you talk about the big red wave. Oh, my God, nation, gas prices, food prices. We're going to clean them out. Just like, you know, 2010. Just like 1994 with you know, what's his name? Newt. Another big oops there. Something happened on the way to the forum, and it wasn't good for us, okay? So we'll talk about that, I hope, in just a few minutes. But the point here is that for me to say that the Democrats could pay a political price for all of these constitutional usurpations, means that the evidence is going to be perfectly clear, which so far it is, and that the public understands it and rejects what the Democrats have done, turning Twitter into a tool of propaganda. That's what you're dealing with, okay? But what happens if all those little, you know, Common Core educated 18 and 19 year olds decide, well, we're the bad guys, America's the bad guys, we believe the what they're talking about, the Green New Deal, we've got to go down that road, we need reparations, we can't get rid of the Biden, you know, people, I mean, it's too important, oh, we got to have it. Okay, if that's the electorate that you're dealing with, I mean, we can sit here and hope like hell we find out the smoking guns and all the rest of it. But in 2024, it may not make a hill of beans. It sure as hell didn't make a hill of beans. And look, I say, okay, I get it. I know they're cheating, the Democrats. I get that, okay? Election integrity is a major issue we have to deal with here. I get that. But let's just assume for a second that maybe there's hope about election integrity and we can have a fair election in 2024. Okay? And maybe I'm just naive to think that. I don't know. But I'm kind of banking on that. But here's what I'm not banking on. An electorate that gets the damn problem. Because these little commies that we've produced here out of the universities and now out of high school, I mean, this is part of BLM, part of Antifa. This is what they want, a Marxist government. They ought to kind of look at Cuba for a second. Did you know that 250,000 Cubans have come across the U.S. border? I didn't know that. I actually read it in the stupid New York Times. I mean, look, the New York Times to me is the slimes. But in order to be prepared for this, I spend my $6, choke on it, and buy the Times on Sunday. Okay? But here's the thing. I mean, for BLM and Antifa and all of these little socialist bastards out there, excuse my French, here, do they really know what's going on in Cuba? And I think that, you know, it's not just Cuba, it's Venezuela, it's everywhere that socialism has been tried. And look, we've been down this road, I'm not going to belabor it, but it's just amazing to think that we can depend upon the electorate to take a close look at these absolute constitutional, you know, problems and think that they're going to do something about it if they have an opportunity in 2024. So where does that leave us? I don't know. We'll have to explore that with somebody who might know more about it, okay? All I'm saying to you is that from a political perspective, if we can't find out the truth about what happened, which we already know the truth, but now we just have to make that truth sink into the electorate, into the national consciousness, and get people riled up about it. If we can't do that, then we are on a slippery slope to the end of a constitutional republic. That's the dimensions of this WTF moment that I've talked about here. That's where we are. And I think that, you know, for Musk to do what he's done is absolutely incredibly good, you know, and they can criticize him all they want. But you know what? And here's another part of this thing with my friends, the New York Slimes. Do you know that in their opinion page, they did not have any substantive opinion analysis of what's going on with the whole Twitter revelation thing? Not one. They had one article that talked about Elon Musk as the king of the pile, because they believed that the virtual world is a fiefdom and he's going to control his part of that fiefdom and it's not going to spill over into the real political world. I mean, now we can have a theoretical argument about that, and that's fine and dandy that they had something like that, but there was not one mention about the substantive arguments that I've just made to you here. And that's across the board with all of them. Fox News shows that, you know, ABC, CBS, and NBC, 0 minutes over these revelations. Okay? And so if you're hearing this stuff for the first time, if you're an NBC, CBS, ABC watcher, I guess this may be a shock. I'm surprised you're even listening, to tell you the truth, that that's your sources for news, okay? And CNN and MSNBC. Okay, I got it. But the point here is that you're seeing a constitutional crisis that really, I suppose you could say it's along the Civil War lines when you think about it. Lincoln's election and the whole question of the expansion of slavery and other issues pertaining to states' rights were part of the mixture of what happened to bring about Civil War. The real question now is, will this kind of constitutional issues be of sufficient danger to most Americans who see it for what it is? Will they rise up and demand accountability? And so my argument to this listening audience, and I'm going to make this to Common Sense and to the Alabama Conservative Coalition, we should all be drilling down on our local federal officials. We should be calling, well, right now, Shelby and Tuberville. We should here locally be calling Jerry Carl and demanding that he takes the lead in fighting with this and making sure that there are no compromises with it. We want investigations. We want a clean house on this. We want these people to go to jail. I mean, somehow McCabe and Strzok and all of those people walked away from the collusion issue. They all have high-paying jobs in CNN and other places in the media. They're rewarded for what they did. We can't have that this go-around. If we can't get the FBI to become the FBI that it should be, then we're going to be on the precipice of a major eruption, because there are too many people out there, veterans, conservatives, that are not going to put up with it. You know? So I guess if CNN is listening to this, I'm going to be shadow banned or whatever. I mean, I'm on Twitter, but I never use it. I get some tweets, but I just don't want to fool with it. But I may have to start fooling with it, because I want this information to get out there to a wider audience. And we're just going to have to take those steps. But my point here is, we need to get our elected officials involved with this, engaged in it, and to fight it. And so, yes, those people will say, well, these Republicans are just going to investigate. They ain't going to do anything. Investigating is part of the job. It's part of the oversight. It's part of the correcting the system that has allowed itself to become so taken over by political power-hungry people who could not see that Donald Trump was someone who was on the right track in terms of China, in terms of jobs, in terms of energy. Go down the damn list, okay? Yes, I get it. And Kevin Spriggs is right. You know, DeSantis without the Trump crazy. I get that. You get all the best with Trump without all the crazy. That's it. But we ain't there yet. And we may not get there unless we see something take place along the lines of what I've suggested, where these people are hammered and subpoenaed, investigated, and then charges brought to bear. And we'll see where it goes. But this is a constitutional crisis of the First Order, I would argue. And we better take it seriously. All right, folks, so there. Now, I've gotten through two things today. Now I've got five more things to do.
In 5 minutes.
Let's see if I can't do something. All right. How about the GOP defeat in Georgia? Well, I mean, here we are. once again, you know, Georgia does us in. So now the Democrats have 51 to 50. Now, we can argue that Herschel Walker was a flawed candidate. Okay, let's take a look at the flawed candidate. Let's take a look about the fact that Warnock had about $138 million that he spent, and Herschel Walker had $38. I mean, the money discrepancy, and again, I hate to put it all on money. I get that, but that's part and parcel of the problem. And so let's go back a few minutes and say, geez, just if Herschel had just won. Well, no, Herschel didn't necessarily have to just win. We had other candidates in New Hampshire and Arizona who could have won, but guess what? You know, King Mitch McConnell decided that, oh no, they're Trump people, I'm not going to support them. And so there was not enough money going to Blake Masters over in Arizona and to General Cool, whatever his name was. And then he spends money to fight against the one woman who should have won against the Alaska girl. What's her name? I can't remember it right now. Okay, Lori's looking at
Sorry.
Me. Yeah, I'm drawing a blank. And then, oh gosh, whatever. I mean, she's the one of the biggest rhinos, but she loves good old McConnell. So what I'm saying here is the Republicans shoot themselves in the foot by making stupid allocations of money. And I said this just a couple of weeks ago. Here you are. McConnell is spending $15 million on a primary here in Alabama. He's going to get something closer to a conservative than anything else, although Britt I would not classify as a conservative. But there was no point in him spending $15 million that could have been used to help someone like Blake Masters or other candidates who came close. In other words, the Republican leadership is as much to blame as this argument about not having good candidates. The reality is that Trump really did have quite a few victories in there. Yes, he had some ones that he lost. I get that. But here again, we get back to a fundamental truth of, you know, American politics. The Democrats seem to know what they're doing. They get their people out for early voting. They use the mail-in balloting. And then they cheat, too. I get that, all right? That's a component that I understand, okay? But nevertheless, what do the Republicans do? I mean, the argument is, come out on Election Day. Well, guess what? There are a whole bunch of Arizonians who came out on Election Day, and look what happened to them. Stood in long lines because suddenly the machines that were supposed to be ready to go weren't ready to go. Now, here again, Carrie Lake is going after them with a lawsuit. Excuse me. Let's just hope that her lawsuit is successful and that they can overturn this. They need to do another election, is what it both was, at least in Maricopa County. I mean, that was a disaster. And yet that's going to stand? You've got to be kidding me. So once again, we get back to, and here again, Maricopa County, they had Republicans who were in charge. And that's another one of these problems where the never Trumpers are across the board, whether it was McConnell, whether it was people in the House. I mean, they're everywhere. The Lincoln Project. And so we're left with the very real possibility that no matter what Carrie Lake does, it may not go anywhere because the infrastructure to do an election is still going to be there. So all I can say is I hope that Carrie Lake continues to fight, and I hope that the RNC itself is overturned, a clean house there. There is an Harmeet Dillon, who is one of the lawyers for Carrie Lake, excuse me, is going to run against Ronna McDaniel. And I think that here again, McDaniel, she's the niece of Mitch Romney. How is it possible for the super, a super never Trumper to have a niece who's running the RNC and think that, that this is going to be an up and up situation? I don't think it is. We're going to push people to get in touch with one of the Republicans who's on the national committee. His name is Paul Reynolds, and move him to try to, you know, vote for Harmeet Dillon, and we're going to press hard on that and get that done. If there's going to be a change, it has to be done. But here's another part of the election integrity change that has to be done. These voter rolls have got to be purged, okay? Mail-in ballots can't just go to anybody who's out there. Again, the Alabama model for absentee voting is the only way that you can ensure some sort of election integrity with mail-in ballots. Again, back to 2005. Jimmy Carter, in his study of all this, basically mail-in ballots is the easiest way for people to cheat. And that's exactly what happened in Georgia in 2020, and we know why. Okay? So, end of all of that. I've got no time left.
No time.
All right, folks. Good Lord. We're running up to Christmas fast. Get your shopping done. Love everybody, I guess, if you can.
And we will, you will be back next Monday.
And we'll be back next Monday. Take care, Lori.
Thank you so much, Dr. Luke. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campominosi of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash. In addition to an anonymous donor, so that we can have an hour instead of a half hour.
That's right.
Thank you, Dr. Lou. If you missed part of the show and you'd like to tell a friend or listen to it later, it will be posted at WABF1480.com. This is WABF, Mobile Fairhope. Great music and memories.